Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SLP Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, join us with a podcast every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702. Or you can also look for SFU on call, Starfleet Universe on call. You should be able to find us there. And of course, we also co-broadcast over on Twitch. That's where you want to. You can actually watch the video feed. You can hear me and actually watch me. See my beautiful face. Or it might crack your screen. I'm not sure which. And over there on twitch.com, just go to twitch.com. Sorry, switch twitch.tv. I apologize. /SFU on call. SFUONCALL. And if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is SFUONCALL@gmail.com. That's SFUONCALL@gmail.com. Also, you want to follow me on Twitter. Also, have a podcast account, which I have specifically set aside for the podcast, which is called SFU on Call. Also, I have a personal account, which is Paul Franz, PaulFranz. There's no T in that, where I mostly just sit there and watch people, and every once in a while I retweet things. And if I retweet things, usually it has to do with the Orioles or the Catholic Church or spirituality overall, and sometimes even tech, which I love all three. Four, if you really divide those two. But anyway, also they have also another account, which is Franz Games, FranzGames, and that one I use for announcing things like, client updates, things happen in Starfleet Warlord, things like that. And of course, this lovely TalkCast gets turned to podcasts available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from ADB. They have new ships on Shapeways this month. We have the Klingon HD5K and HD5, the Federation Light Dreadnought Carrier, the General Augmented Mobile Logistics Base, the General Mobile Logistics Base, and the General Small Freighter, both with and without the skid. And of course, we can move on to SFB Online. We have the Sapphire Star Limit Tournament, and that is actually round one is finally completed. With round two, we are waiting for two of the four games to be completed. Those are the games that just got previously finished. So hopefully they will get those done post-haste and post-toasty. And moving on to the library, not much happening there this week. No corrections and no additions. So with that was the news for this week. And it's me, it's Nolan, Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we've got Barry. Hey, Barry.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing good. We have Gary. How you doing, Gary?
Oh, hello. Just a quick note. The folks over at Battlegroup Toronto announced that they're going to be hosting a table this weekend over in Scarborough. That's like a easternmost neighborhood in the city of Toronto this Saturday. So I guess, well, if you listen to this before the 4th of June.
Right.
And the info has been posted on the BBS. They should be there from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in the vicinity, because not everyone lives in Canada, and I'm not sure how many people actually have their passports in order. And I'm not sure what the COVID protocol is these days when it comes to crossing into Canada from the United States.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
Used to be harder to get into Canada than the United States. Now it's the reverse.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You have to.
Because it.
Continue.
Yeah. It used to be that you needed to get tested for COVID within 72 hours prior to the border crossing to get into Canada. And now Canada said, that's not needed anymore. The United States now has that requirement to get back into the States, even for U.S. citizens.
Gotta love it. The age of COVID.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the numbers are going up again, unfortunately. So, anyhow.
I'm not going.
Yeah, don't let it lie. Just let it lie.
And also, there's a handful of new ships that were released on Shipwave this week as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe about a dozen or so. Gene's already posted about them if anyone wants to check that list out as well.
Right, the Federation Light Dreadnought and Carrier, Light Dreadnought Carrier, sorry. A couple Klingon ships, the HD5K and HD5, and a small freighter, both with and without the skid, and logistics base. And this one, it just sounds weird. I'm not sure what that means. Federation Flatbed Operational Carrier.
I think that's the one, because there was an issue of Stellar Shadows that basically did an SSD for Captain's Edition based on the old flatbed CBO.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm pretty sure that ship had already been released in different scales, but I think now it's being released in the 1 to 7,000 or Elite scale as well.
Right. Yeah, that's 7,100? Yeah, 7,000, yeah, right. No, that's fine. Newest. That's one to look at this momentarily because it's been a while. Oh, okay, yeah. Yep. I remember that one. I remember, where did I first see that? I'm thinking I saw it on the front cover of one of the captain's logs. I think that was it. Because I remember it was a color picture. Oh, so that's why I think it was.
It's on the front cover of Stellar Shadows Journal Number 1.
Ah, okay. Okay, I have that one. Yeah, that's one thing I've been doing my best to do lately, actually, is for the captain's logs, is kind of do a little conversion. Converting them from hard copy to soft copy. Oh, sorry. Hard copy to electronic form to reduce the amount of stuff I got laying around the house. So
I can understand that.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to trim it all down because even I've got a 1,400 square foot house and
I understand completely.
Yep. And Lord knows, Barry, I think you need to do some trim down yourself because, dang.
Oh, I know. Every time I come home, there's less and less room. It's scary. It's almost,
mm-hmm. Understood. Okay, well, moving on to back to Starfleet Universe-related material discussions. Gary brought up a topic which he wanted to discuss. I want to belay that just for a moment because I wanted to finish up what I had actually started last week, which was at the beginning of the podcast, I was talking a lot about Starfleet Battle Force and how it was really a great card game and that it was not... originally came out, it was designed to be kind of a competitor to, I blanked on it. Dang. The big card game back in the day, the collectible card game that was just killed everybody. That's awful. I forgot what it was.
Well, wasn't
I don't know if there's enough magic.
Magic the Gathering. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Gary. But,
although, the fair to think of that Battle Force was never really designed to be collectible in the same way.
Right.
Like, it was pretty much a one-off set, which made, like, some of the Captain's Log expansions, like giving you sample Lyra and Hydrant cards, tricky because the core game was too finely balanced.
Yeah.
As a self-contained unit. That it made it harder to add in more cards.
Oh, I totally agree. And that is obviously one of the big issues with Starfleet Battle Force, which is the whole idea of Starfleet Battle Force when it came out was it was the anti Magic the Gathering. You have a card game which you don't have to buy more cards. You don't have to spend more money.
That's a plus.
You know?
That was a major plus.
Right. Exactly. And with Starfleet Battle Force, it's no longer a tactical game. Which is why I'm surprised. Maybe it's ADB's marketing or what? Because especially these days, to be honest, I don't see that many new games coming out that are tactical board games. Maybe it's just that, you know, I don't really watch that industry that much. I watch board games, and most of those board games are not tactical, where you actually have to move, you know, this hex to this hex to this hex, or this square to this square to this square. You know, it's
most of them these days are Euro games.
Right. They're abstracted out. You know, what's that? Jeez. Oh,
yeah.
That one that you play, like takes like 6 hours to play. Galactic something. I forget what it was.
Twilight Imperium.
Twilight Imperium. Thank you. That's Twilight Imperium. That's why I screwed myself up. Okay. So, to me, that's the beauty of Starfleet Battle Force, you know, is that it's not a tactical board game, so it should be open to more people, you know. So instead of just being for the geeks who love tactical games, whether it's board games or miniatures or whatever, where you're actually moving pieces on a board and the spatial arrangement defines tactics and strategy and all that, you know, like Warhammer 4K, you know, where you actually have the little miniatures that,
right.
And you build up these whole big things that you have for your battlefield and so forth. You paint your miniatures and you bring forth your armies and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I don't, other than the ones with the miniatures, I don't, you know, as I said, I haven't been focused on that part of the market, but, you know, so I just see that the tactical board games are lesser, don't draw in as many people as once were, because I was saying, if it's a game like that, you should be playing it on the computer, you know. The problem is with computer games.
Well, bear in mind that bear in mind that people continue to keep throwing money at Catalyst Game Labs every time they do a BattleTech Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to between things like there's going to be a new box set for the Alpha Strike, like the faster playing tabletop game set in the BattleTech world universe, and that's going to be coming out soon. And then actually, they're also going to be doing. Like a kind of more kind of board gamey kind of game. Apparently, there's been previews of it at conventions already called BattleTech Command or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the picture seems to show these little kind of like little figurines and stuff. It's like, I'm not sure how to explain it, whatever. But I mean, reportedly, it seems to be that like that game system is basically doing pretty much as like game universe rather, because it's not just one system anymore. Has been doing almost as well as it's ever been, and in the sense that. They've really been able to, you know, push forward into the new Ilklan era, and
mm-hmm.
all of their new source books are full color printed now, and they've got a new Mercenaries Kickstarter where they're going to have dozens of revamped battle mechs that people are going to be able to pay money for, and I mean, it hasn't opened up yet, but considering the amount of money that was kicked around for them in the previous one, that basically helped launch the current wave of success for them. I mean, there's certainly something to be said in terms of a tabletop war game that's basically handled well and with like a clear set of goals and you know, with an enthusiastic fan base. So I wouldn't be too much of a in a hurry to sprint away from that from that concept.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, I don't want to completely go off the rails based on what you're saying, because like even when it comes to what Catalyst are doing, because they also run the Shadowrun franchise, and the kind of products that they're doing for Shadowrun have also been successful, but they're in a very different space. Like, for example, they've been doing card game. I think there's some sort of like combat card game that they've done for Shadowrun. I'm trying to think of what it is. But the thing is, though, is that Shadowrun at its core was based on an RPG, and everything else came secondary.
Right, I remember.
Whereas Battletech does have RPGs, but its core is based on mech combat. So they're, I guess, the kind of Venn diagram of what overlaps with what is very different between the two. So when it comes to the SFU, I guess maybe taking a closer look at some of these competitor or companion, I guess, because there's people who play both Battletech and the SFU, game systems that are not quite as big as the ones from Games Workshop, and they're also not quite as apart from, you know, the same kind of thing that you have with Settlers of Catan or whatever, that is kind of roughly comparable in terms of how long the game system's been, the universe has been around, and how, you know, varied it is in terms of the scales that you can jump into. I wonder, maybe those might be pretty good points of comparison in terms of where a card game or something similar like that could work going forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes,
so I played MechWarrior 2 in the Battletech universe back in the day, and that was pre-Pentium Pro. I think the computer I had was a Cyrix chip. 686, if you remember Cyrix.
Damn. Yep, I remember Cyrix. I could pronounce Cyrix because it was Cyrix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a computer I was using to play MechWarrior on, and which was an okay processor. It was cheap, but Cyrix went out of business shortly thereafter.
Right.
But I like that universe, and but I never really got back into it. And I think part of the reason was, to really play that game properly, you needed to have a joystick, and I never bought another one.
Understood. Yeah.
For some reason, I just never.
Oh.
Well, if it helps, there was a team called Harebrained Schemes that had a PC game published for Battletech set during the late Succession Wars. And I think it was first released in 2018. And it should be available on Steam if you have that. So if you want to stick with the video game side of things, then those kind of things are an option. But then on the other hand, if you'd rather go with like a tabletop stuff, there's actually going to be a new product that's coming out in book form, and there's PDF up as well, called Battletech Universe. And its goal is basically to kind of act as an overall primer for the setting through to the year 3150, which is basically the end of the Dark Age and the eve of the new era that they're in now with the Ill Clan. So I guess for anyone who's either an old veteran of the universe, either through tabletop or video game, or someone who's never seen it before and is wondering why I'm turning this into Battletech on call instead of Star Trek Universal call, that's going to be something coming out. But when I think about it, there isn't really a comparable product that ADB have right now that's like a Starfleet universe, basically, that's agnostic to any of the game systems. I mean, there's a free PDF that gives you a little small bit of information about that sort of thing, but there isn't the same kind of like guide to the universe that this thing is going to be like. So, but again, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself because we haven't seen what this new product is going to look like. I mean, supposedly it's going to be like a full-color coffee table book with all sorts of stuff or whatever, but exactly what kind of detail it has and how well it works remains to be seen. So, to be continued, I should say.
Oh,
but, yeah, so basically, as I say, I guess the point I'm trying to get at is that the folks at Catalyst, they're not just trying to plow forward into a new era and also new source books or whatever, but they're trying to think of different approaches in terms of how new or lapsed gamers, I should say, can get up to speed without having to buy a dozen books or feel intimidated by the size of the rule books or whatever. So, so basically just, I guess that's like another point. Maybe one day like it might be an idea to dedicate an episode of this show to dissecting those kind of things and just kind of like picking it, not so much to try to, as I say, turn it into BattleTech on call, but more to figure out like how that would compare to what ABB has on offer in terms of getting the word out about the SFU.
Okay, so let me see if I understand what the product is supposed to, basically supposed to be. Like, it's supposed to be like a history of the BattleTech universe. Am I getting that right?
So it would seem, because right now the free PDF that's like a super quick primer that only has like a page or two about like, you know, there's a page on each of the great houses, there's a page on the clans, there's a page that basically breaks down the seven main eras. And this thing is basically going to be more in-depth. So there's actually a page that they have on the BattleTech website where they have a link of the upcoming releases. And if you scroll down, you can actually see there's info about some of the things that are coming up, like the Office Right box set and also the BattleTech Universe book. So it puts into words, I guess, more succinctly than I'm managing to now. So I don't know if you want to take a second to look at that, or if you want to, if I'm distracting from the Starfleet Battle Force topic that you really had in mind.
I just had the question about, okay, so basically it's introduction into it's kind of the mini history of the BattleTech universe of, okay, these are the different things that are part of the BattleTech universe. I agree, you know, the ADB currently doesn't have that kind of thing that talks about, you know, a separate product, which is basically talking about the Zinnies and the Klingons and the Federation, which, you know, I'm not too concerned about the Federation of Planets and the Klingons and the Romulans, because most people know those. It's the ones like the ISC, the Wins, the Zinnies, and a little bit of the history between the Winnies and the Zinnies and the Wind Cluster, and the Hydras and so forth. Which would be obviously a good history lesson about that. Now, the question is, one, would that sell? And two, obviously people have to be interested in it, but two, is it needed? Because, matter whether it's needed or not. The question is whether it sells. That's the ultimate question, really. When it comes to any product, like it's put out there, will it sell? Chris Nozia is saying, hell yes. So...
Right. I would imagine there's a bigger fan base for BattleTech than there is for Starfleet Battles, because that was a widely sold computer game.
Well, also, you do realize, Barry, that it began as a board game. With, you know, it was a board game with SSDs like Starfleet Battles. You know, I used to play it.
I did not know that.
I played it as a board game when it first came out when I was in college. And we had these little little stands, and Well, it was on, you put on the stands were these little cardboard cutouts of the different mechs. And then you'd move it around the board. And the you know, of course, the board was basically a terrain map. And depends upon, you know, you have, depending upon whether you were in the water or at elevated or what. And of course, you have to worry about heat that the techs, the mechs were producing when you're firing weapons or moving. You know,
oh, yeah.
Obviously, you want to be in the water so that the heat sinks would you know, because water is a big heat sink, you know. You know, so, and then when you got damage, I forget exactly how you did damage, except for I remember you would roll it, and then you would, depends upon where you hit on the mech, whether it was an arm or a leg and so forth, and then if like you got your arm, your leg shot off, then you might no longer be able to move, you know. Well, right. if both legs were blown off, then you couldn't move.
Yeah.
Yeah. The
heat mechanism for Mech Warrior, I thought was ingenious, and I love that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well.
Yeah. So I guess if you think about, Barry, if you think about how, you know, we've got Starfleet battles and you've got Federation Commander and mm-hmm. Call to Arms, but the way in which each starship is represented, like if you look at an SSD, it's somewhat similar to a ship card. But if you compare it to, say, Starmada or Call to Arms, those representations are much more abstract. So Battletech, like the board game or the tabletop versions, does something similar. So as Paul was saying, the classic version of Battletech has a thing called a record sheet. And those record sheets basically have specific locations for like mechs, arms, legs, and stuff. And on each location, you've got armor points and you've got structure points. And but then there's a game, Alpha Strike, which is a more fast-playing game, that has a more abstracted unit card, which has only a set of bubbles for your armor and a set of bubbles for the structure points. But it doesn't tell you where on the mech those are. So you're basically able to play a game of Alpha Strike in a much quicker period of time relative to classic Battletech. But not everyone's looking for that. So the same as with SFB. I mean, some people want, you know, the kitchen table sized, you know, set of Master Robux, and other people just want to have something that they can get a game in a much quicker time. So as is the case with what ADB's doing, the current license holders for Battletech, they're called Catalyst Game Labs. They're basically pursuing multiple venues in terms of trying to get the universe into people's hands.
That makes sense. And the board or the computer game was more like the former version that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that you see in some of the more recent video games as well.
Yeah, it's been a while since I did play Mech Warrior back in the day.
Yeah, that was an awesome game.
True, very true. Whatever.
Yeah.
Forget.
So yeah, just very finally before I turn the mic over again. That book I'm talking about, Battletech Universe, the coffee table one, and it says here, for example, it's going to have fiction excerpts from different novels that have been published over the years, because there's dozens and dozens of novels set in the Battletech Universe as well. And it also has, apparently, each section will give you a list of suggestions for further reading. So the idea is that, sure, there's lots of source books out there, but if you don't know what to look for, then this book will tell you. If you're interested in the clans, read these books about the clans. Mm-hmm. Or if you're interested in the Federated Sons, this is Handbook House Davy, and that sort of thing. That's my assumption anyway, because, as I say, we have to wait and see until the actual book is published. But so I think that's the kind of thing. It'd be almost like if there was a similar book for the SFU, you could basically say, all right, well, here's a chapter on the Interstellar Concordium. And then, all right, so if you find this interesting, where are you going to find more material for them? And so you'd say, SFB, go to Module C2, Federation Commander, go to War and Peace, and Starmada, the upcoming Starmada Rules of Wars, and for Fed and Empire, by the ISC War Source Book, and so on and so on. So you're basically, you've got an introduction in terms of, like, you know, hopefully basically raising awareness, although it does help the fact that I think it helps that because the ISC were one of the factions that were in the Starfleet Command 2 video game, because that's actually how I myself found out about the ISC, because I played the Starfleet Command games before I played before I got into the SFU. So, well, of course,
you played Starfleet Command, the computer game, before you played Starfleet Battles?
Yeah, because I'd never seen any of the material for the SFU until after I played. And it wasn't actually, because the first Starfleet Command game, it was kind of interesting-ish, but it was really Volume 2.
Yes.
That had the ISC in it. That was the one that got me more interested. Because then, like, I wanted to learn more about the ISC. And then turns out the ISC is, like, really different. I mean, some of the mechanics are the same in terms of the plasma and the PPD, but the ships look very different. And also, the video game guys invented a sixth species that don't exist in ADB's ISC. So I had to unlearn some of that stuff for the Starfleet universe.
You're talking about,
but yeah,
they had a species that were instead of the Kazini, right?
No, well, that too.
That too, yeah.
So they
renamed
them. Five standard species, but then, yeah. So five standard species, they had them.
Right. They did not have, they couldn't get the approval from Larry Niven who held the copyrights for the Kazini, if I remember correctly.
So they invented a wolf-like species called the Mirax Star League.
Right.
Yes.
Which is ironic, because when you think about it, the Carnivons are more wolf-like than the Kazintis, but the ships didn't fly like Carnivon ships, they still flew like Kazinti ships.
Right.
Right. Well, Larry, and it's funny, because Larry Niven, where the Kazintis came from, is Larry Niven wrote basically one episode of the animated series where he introduced, it was a slaver episode, where the Federation people found a slaver box from the Man's in Wars universe, and that's how Zinni's got introduced into the Starfleet universe. Or at least the it wasn't TOS, but it was the animated, which was pre movies. With original cast.
Although, of course, the ADB are required to make the Starfleet Universe Kazintis separate from, for example, like the classic Kazinti have bat ears and kind of a hunched shoulders, and there's a few other things, like the females don't speak, but in the Starfleet Universe, they have cat ears and they don't have any tails, and they walk upright. And, of course, they've got the Lirans and Carnivons as genetic relatives. So, what was funny is that some of the more recent actual franchise shows have included Kazintis. Like, there's a Kazinti character in Star Trek Lower Decks, but that character is based on the slaver weapon version of the Kazinti rather than the Starfleet Universe Kazintis.
This is a current generation. I guess who owns the rights to the Starfleet Universe at this point? Who's been producing it? It's not Disney. It's
Paramount.
Well, it was Paramount. Paramount. Okay, it's still Paramount. Okay, and Disney didn't buy Paramount yet. Oh, and they introduced the Zinnies back in.
Well, they've had... haven't shown... Okay, so, allegedly, because when Star Trek Enterprise was cancelled, it was in Season 4, and it finally got good as well, because it actually was able to lean into the prequel TOS stuff, rather than the time travel stuff. But so supposedly the same showrunner for Season 4, he had plans for Season 5 had they not been cancelled. And one of his plans was to introduce the Kazinti. But allegedly they were going to give them a ship that looked like a Starfleet Universe ship. But whether that's true or not is another story. But because I don't know if ADB would have had to be involved with that or signed off on that or not. But in any case, the current shows like Lower Decks and stuff, their Kazinti characters, or Xin characters, whatever, they're basically based more on the bat-eared ones, like from the slaver weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they've been trying to kind of like subvert some of the stereotypes. Like, for example, there's a scene where, because in Lower Decks, the character walks around upright, but then he purposely does a bit where he crouches down, like in the Slaver Weapon, basically just to kind of, like, you know, play up the fact that he's not the stereotype or whatever. So, but so they're still kind of doing slightly their own thing with it. But yeah, but the thing is, I mean, like, Paramount's got enough money to throw around. I guess they could, they can, you know, get the rights to it. I'm not too sure what the situation is for them to use it rather than for anyone else to use it. But in any case, it's being used. So there's that. But,
interesting.
Yeah. So,
because there the mechanics for the Zinni universe are star travel is completely different than it is in the Federation universe. They're using hyperdrive instead of warp drive.
True.
And they're using inertialess. I think the Zinnis had grav plates. I think they had inertialess drives. So it wasn't like Star Trek where it was, we can go from zero to light speed like in a couple of seconds. In the Zinn universe, it was like, yeah, we got about 200 G's acceleration, which will get you up to light speed in, what, 2-3 weeks?
Yeah, well, it's a different universe. It's the only thing that's even close to being the same is the name of the race. You know?
Yeah.
And that's the
Slaver Weapon anyway, because I think the original plan, like, for the when they were put into the animated series episode, is that they're a parallel universe version of the ones from his own books in the first instance. They just happen to look and act similar, but they're not necessarily, they wouldn't necessarily have the same background.
Oh, okay. So he basically just took his characters and put them into a different universe and said, yeah, whatever, hand wave them.
So it would seem, but again, I don't want to speak for him, so I'm sure that there's plenty of articles out there dissecting that sort of thing. So.
Right, and Paramount, of course, would not have looked at ADD and said, oh, okay, we're going to make it drone-based and lasers and disruptors, because they don't. They completely ignored ADB, which I understand that, because...
Yeah, and licensing with ADB is really tenuous, because it's not a Paramount license. It's a Franz Joseph license, is what it is, and Paramount owns that license now. But the agreement itself still is in place as originally created by Franz Joseph and ADB. Which is taking the original technical book and creating a game out of it. You know? So it's not not based on the universe directly. And therefore, you know.
Oh, I know.
Which is, if you really think about it, it's a really sly move. You know, instead of actually trying to get, you know, get Paramount in on it, or whoever owned the Star Trek franchise at that point to license from them, he licensed directly from the source material for Star Trek.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing to bear in mind is that, I mean, back in the mid-70s, there was no Star Trek franchise. I mean, the show, even the animated series, was dead, and there wasn't the same kind of due diligence in terms of, like, a media corporation being on top of things in terms of licensing rights. Like, those kind of things evolved over time. But I was under the impression that ADB actually have multiple licenses. I mean, there's a license with the estate of Franz Joseph himself for the technical manual stuff, and there is a there's a separate agreement with Paramount representing the things, those things from the show that are allowed to be in the SFU, but no more. So, for example, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, you can have Gorn ships, although the Gorns There's no Metrons in it because basically anything that hadn't already been put into the SFU at the time of the Paramount Agreement is now off limits.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then also,
well, the
I think there's the third agreement with Larry Niven for the Xfinities.
Yeah. What, Barry?
Oh, I did not. Yeah, I did not know that they had made an agreement with Larry Niven for the Xfinities.
But I think that's the agreement that specifies that the Starfleet Universe version of the species has to be separate, like in terms of their biology and everything, from the ones in other universes. And I don't know if that's part of the reason why things got awkward for Tal'Dorei, like when they were doing the video games, because maybe they just didn't want to pay the extra money to add them in, so they basically just decided that they'd come up with the Mirak instead and just use the same ships. Because technically the ships were created by ADB. I mean, they don't match anything that was put on screen for the in the Slaver weapon. So, because I think they just had a generic flying saucer in that episode. So, yes, they could separate the technology from the biology in that sense.
Right. And
yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember what the ship actually looked like in the animated. I don't think they really went into the look of the Kazuni ship.
Yeah, I never watched the animated series, so I don't remember.
In some ways, it was very well done.
The ship was pink. Chris Nosey is saying the ship was pink. It's like, okay.
Apparently, one of the producers on the show was colorblind, so he not necessarily on purpose, but. Right. Some of the things ended up being wrong color. So, for example, there was an episode with an Andorian character, but he ended up being gray instead of blue. But that's because he thought it was blue when it was being filmed or when it was being put together. So I guess it was too late to go back afterwards.
Oh, so, understood. Yeah, Chris was mentioning the same thing.
Marex or something like that. The name of that character is Marex. He was, because I don't think they had, they couldn't get one of the, actors to either Walter or George, they couldn't get him to sign on to reprise his role. So they got another one, so then Dorian to replace him. I can't remember if.
Oh, okay. So Walter Koenig wasn't involved. Although Walter Koenig actually wrote an episode of the animated series, but he didn't show up as Chekhov. But so Arix was created as an alien to be the helmsman. And actually, funny enough, another member of his species has also shown up in Star Trek Lower Decks. Because, like, Lower Decks in particular has really gone full out in terms of, like, super obscure, like, deep-cut Star Trek references from, like, the past, you know, 50-odd years, 60-odd years of franchise. So, but there was an episode where I think it involved the Guardian of Forever. It was basically what the universe would have looked like if Spock had died when he was a kid. And so Spock's replacement was an Andorian, Thelev or something like that. And that character, he only appeared in that one episode. But he was the wrong color because of allegedly because of the color blindness thing. So it's actually a shame it's taken so long for more Andorians to show up in the franchise. Because, I mean, it took until Star Trek Enterprise for them to be a significant factor. And even then, I mean, there's an Enar character. The Enar are kind of like they're like a subspecies of the Andorians. There's one of those guys is the chief engineer in Strange New Worlds. But there haven't been too many like face characters who have been Andorians proper. Although there's a side character on Lower Decks who's Andorian. So, but
there were a couple of books, New Worlds or Strange New Worlds, that were written in the 70s, and I don't know, those were fan fiction, but I don't know, it was a collection of short stories, but I don't, is that Strange New Worlds, is that based on those two books, or?
No, okay, so you may have heard about Star Trek Discovery, which was basically like the first of the current era of streaming series, because in the U.S. they're all on Paramount Plus.
Right.
And in Canada, they're on a streaming service called Crave, but they're also on a TV show, a TV network called CTV Sci-Fi Channel. So Discovery was the first of this current batch of programs. And in season two of Discovery, they introduced the Enterprise, but it was Captain Pike's Enterprise. So it was basically after the Cage, but before the original series. So Spock was there, and Number One is there, and Pike himself. And so they were a super popular addition to Season 2, although I'm still not 100% sold on the way the Enterprise itself looks. But I mean, mm-hmm. It's too late for that. But anyway, trio, like the actors they got for them, were so popular that people were clamoring for, give them their own show. And so starting about 5 weeks ago, Paramount Plus and Crave in Canada have that show, and the show is actually called Star Trek Strange New Worlds.
Yep. Yeah. I've only watched 4 episodes. I'm watching the 5th. I'm in the middle of watching the 5th. So.
Yeah, I watched like a couple episodes of Discovery, and it just went into the weeds. And it's like,
yeah.
I'm sorry, the writing was just so horrible.
Yeah, I watched maybe 2 episodes of Discovery, and I went, this is not for me. No.
Yeah. It was like, really? No. It just didn't make sense. It was like, most of the first episode with Pike, it's like, it's got some possibilities.
Yeah, And not to be a spoiler, but if you start watching it, it's the first thing that shows up. So I'll let you know beforehand, which is at the beginning of Strange New Worlds, Pike, he visits this planet, which has him see basically his own death. You know, when it becomes the Pike that we all know, you know, the burned kind of Hulk that he can't really do anything about. You know, he knows.
Yeah. The Berthold radiation. The Berthold radiation. Or the Delta. He got Delta radiation. He went into an engine room that was leaking radiation, pulled out a whole bunch of cadets. And save their lives, but knowing that he was getting exposed to a radiation that would turn him into a cripple.
Yep. And he knows when it's supposed to happen. It's supposed to happen in 10 years. And, you know, so a lot of the first episode was dealing with knowing that you're going to, in 10 years, this is what's going to happen to you. You know, you're not going to be dead, but, you know, this great event's going to be happening to you. You know, so just
Well, for what it's worth, the scene with the where he finds out about that is actually because, okay. So I'm trying to not to. Well, I mean, I guess it's been out for a while. So, basically, Discovery from season 3 onwards has actually skipped ahead to the 32nd century, but to get to the 32nd century, they need to basically do some sort of like time travel shenanigans. And as part of it, Pike has to go to this planet where there's like a Klingon monastery.
Right.
And the monks there, they basically watch over these time crystals. And he has to take a time crystal to do the time travel-y thing. But the thing is, though, is that when you grab the crystal, that's what basically shows you your fate. But if you take the crystal, then the fate is locked in stone. So he knew what he was doing, basically, because... He knew that it would be a big sacrifice, so he did it anyway. But I guess as they show in the start of Strange New Worlds, he didn't realize that his mind is going to be reliving those things. Because it's not just a case of, like, watching it on TV.
Right.
Like, he feels the experience of suffering, whatever. So I guess he didn't realize just how badly the PTSD was going to be. So that's kind of where you pick up in Strange New Worlds. So I'm not saying that you have to watch all of Discovery Season 1 and 2 to get caught up. But there are a couple of individual scenes that might help provide a bit of context as to where he starts off with. But the thing is, though, is that Strange New Worlds so far has been pretty good in terms of being pretty self-contained in that.
Yeah.
You don't really have to have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything else that's going on to enjoy it.
Oh, agreed. Discovery.
So turned off by Discovery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't watch, as I said, I watched 2 episodes of Discovery and that was it. I was done. Know nothing of that the history except for the little bit of history that they showed at the beginning of the show. The first episode, and the funny thing was that this last episode, season, episode 5, they're having this battle per se, combat, personal combat, fighting that's occurring, and I'm listening to the background music, and I'm going, that's from the original series. They're using the same music that they used in the original series.
Alexander Courage's music. And Alexander Courage did a phenomenal job with the music.
Yeah, which was interesting.
You know who used that same music really, really well? Was there was some fan fiction. What was it called? Star Trek Continues. Did you ever see that?
No.
They made like 8 or 9 episodes, and then Paramount. And it, oh.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Did you? Yeah. No. I never got to watch it.
That was phenomenal. Oh, that was amazing. It's on YouTube. These 8 or 9, and that might even be more episodes than that. But they basically continued some of the episodes. I think the first one was they took the episode "Who Mourns for Adonis," and they went like, "Okay, let's continue that episode a couple of weeks later,
right?
And see where or see where we're at." And they actually got the same actor who played Adonis in the original series. But they said, okay, due to certain things, he had aged like 40 years.
Right.
Because the actor had aged 40 years.
Right.
And, but, oh my God, the acting in that one and the writing in that one was phenomenal. And in a lot of ways, they exceeded the original Star Trek. That is one of the best Star Trek series they ever made. And then Paramount told them, you're not allowed. They said, if you make another episode of that, we're suing you. And they're like, okay, well, it's all. They weren't making any money at it because they were just doing it fan fiction and posting on YouTube. And like, well, one lawsuit and went
well, blind. So in fairness, I think it's more a case that there was another supposed fan production that basically tried to get a bit ahead of itself in terms of its thing. And when in Paramount responding to that, they basically end up changing the roles for everybody else. So every production
pretty much
got caught up in the wake of that big problem. So I guess it's kind of unfortunate, but so I wouldn't necessarily say it was Paramount basically looking directly at these guys. Because I think, I could have sworn that there's a place in New York State where they made that show, but the actual set for the bridge... Mm. They're able to come up with some sort of agreement where it became like an official tour place, so people can actually they got some sort of license where people can actually go and visit it, and then Paramount get a cut or something like that, whatever. So I don't know if that's true or not, but they were on better terms
New York?
Than
yeah
something other, like that. I don't have the full details on that.
Yeah, the other show that was very well done. But I guess they really didn't respect Paramount's intellectual property, and that's what got the what was the name of it?
Axanar?
Axanar, that was it. Prelude to Axanar was did you ever see that one?
Me, no.
And they've been making... They made Prelude to... What's that?
No, I did not. I've not seen Axanar.
Well, they made Prelude to Axanar, which was a trailer. And then it's like, okay. And now they've spent like 10 years trying to make a 45-minute episode of the actual Axanar. And 10 years later, and they're still working on it. It's like, guys, come on. It's just insane how long that's taken them.
Yeah. Well, when it's not your primary job, you know how many hours it takes.
Oh, I know, I know, I know. The problem is the actors are aging as they're making this thing.
Well, hopefully they've got the scenes down. You know, it's just, you know, things like special effects and because, you know, back in the day, you know, special effects were pretty basic overall, you know.
Right.
Using models, using physical effects, you know, to do things, or you know,
right.
you know, like the, how they did the transporters, you know, that wasn't the very computer. Yeah. I forgot how they used it, how they did it.
I know. Well, I got to get going here.
Okay.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. See you.
Good night. Yeah. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Library.
Yeah. But anyhow, yeah, the overall when it comes to ADB's getting back to actually talking about Starfleet Universe and not as a little less Star Trek and more Starfleet Universe. The licensing is my only one I know of is about Franz Josef. It would not surprise me if ADB had a agreement with Larry Niven when it comes to the use of the name Zinti. And as part of that, it had the actual race itself had to be described differently, so that he would be okay with it. So there'd be, i.e., there wouldn't be any confusion that the Zinti and Zin were definitely completely and utterly different. Now, when it comes to Paramount, my guess is that's more of an agreement than a license. The license is from Franz Josef. I'm sure what Paramount has told ADB via an agreement with them saying, okay, look, we can't force you to give up your license because you've got a valid license for the material. But these are the parameters where if you go past the certain you go past what it was in the original series and you start infringing on newer IP based on that original Star Trek, then we're gonna take the license. Then at that point, we'll have that as breach of contract and probably get rid of, you know, then we'll have this whole thing gone. That would be my guess. I do not know for a fact. I've not talked to ADB about the whole issue with Paramount and also the whole issue with Larry with Zinti and Larry Niven. So that's my take on it, you know, knowing what as little as I know. But you know, as I've said before about the licensing agreement, I'm confident that, you know, if Steve Cole would bite, you know, kick the bucket, you know, tonight we would be, you know, SFP Online would be fine. So That was the one thing I was concerned about when I last talked to him about the licensing. But anyhow, what were you gonna say, Gary?
I'm actually just thinking because there is a page in most of the rule books that specifies this product exists under licensing agreements X, Y, Z. I'm just trying to see if I can bring it up because. Of course, I dug out the rule book to look up the, you know, the stuff we were talking about earlier about tactical intelligence and passive fire control. So that didn't really work out too well. But
No, it did not. We got sidetracked. I wanted to finish up the Starfleet Battle Force. Obviously, that did not occur. So
let me take further back here. Here we go. Copyright and publishers information.
No, I was doing it's actually.
That's just about Emeril Lagasse itself. Day of Inquiry for Real Kind. Copyright information. Elements of the Starfleet Universe. Oh, sorry. This game was produced under license from Franz Joseph Designs, authors of the Starfleet Technical Manual. Elements of the Starfleet Universe are the property of Paramount Pictures Corporation and are used with their permission.
Right.
But, yeah. So, but, you know, that's fine because, you know, I think the SFU more than stands on its own in terms of all of the material that's been created and, you know, all the new empires that exist. So it's only really, I guess, the whole reason why this topic blew up in the first place is because I was mentioning how when the Starfleet Command video games were being made, the first 2.5 of them anyway, the company Tauldron that produced them, they basically did a kind of like a hybrid licensing agreement of their own. So from the ADB side, they got some of the game mechanics and the ship designs. Not so much in terms of what you see, but in terms of how they're modeled in gameplay. But then on the other hand, they took the license from Paramount to basically make the ships look like the movie era ships. So instead of the classic Constitution class ship, the Federation CA looked like the movie era refit.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about that, but I'll take your word for it. Because I know later on it was, you know, I know that previously, you know, when the first Starfleet Command came out, my understanding is that the licensing agreement was mainly basically with ADB. When it comes to definitely with the mechanics,
no, it definitely had the movie era ships and stuff like the native SFUM ships like the Lyrans and Hydrans. They totally reinvented them, so they don't look anything like what we'd be familiar with.
Right,
and so. And then, actually, what's interesting is that because in Volume 2, they actually got George Takei to narrate part of it as Captain Sulu. Because basically, the idea is that the version of the IFC in that storyline, he was kind of like, the Excelsior was like involved with that, which of course can't happen in ADB's version. But yeah, so I suppose that's kind of like there hasn't really been a similar products the same way that Battletech has had a much broader variety of games based on that. But then the licensing issue is different again because, in a sense, Battletech actually had the reverse problem that the ADB has had because there was that whole saga about the so-called unseen mechs. And so for a long time, if you buy an official Battletech product, there'd be like a blanked out silhouette basically representing your mech. So it was like, well, what am I using? And so it basically took a long time for them to get to the point where they basically decided that they'd pretty much redesign the mechs to function the way that they're supposed to function in the universe.
Right.
But not look like anyone else's IP. So I guess they're re-seen or new-seen or whatever.
Yeah, well,
so,
come on. Let's be honest.
Move further away from that.
So. Yeah, let's be honest. When Battletech came out, they stole the look for the Wasp, at the very least, the Wasp, if not some of the other mechs. I think Wasp was one of them. There was some other ones also, which are they stole them directly from Battletech. It's not Battletech, Robotech.
Well, I think it's more like they signed the licensing agreements, but they didn't. But the thing is that even in Japan, a lot of these licensing agreements didn't get sorted out for a long time because, I mean, the whole thing was a mess, like on both sides of the Pacific for a long time. So I don't think there was a lack of good faith. It was just maybe due diligence. But I mean, you couldn't really Google it back then. So I think it was just an unfortunate set of circumstances. But in any case, I guess the one advantage that Battletech has had is that when the clans showed up, they basically were able to create entirely new mechs like the Timberwolf and stuff. And the Timberwolf design has been so good and so iconic that they've been able to basically lean into it for the last 30 years as something that they own exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so, but by comparison, it'd be like, I'm trying to think of my comparison, actually. Because, I mean, even to this day, I mean, the SFU, I mean, there's, sure, you can buy, like, Lyran and heavy cruisers, and you've got the IFC ships, and Omega, and LMC, and stuff. But, and of course, even, like, the Federation have things like the NCL, that sort of thing. But, the stars of the show are still those ships that are licensed from the original Troy video programs. So fortunately, ADB has never had that problem that the Battletech license holders have had. But so yeah, anyway, I didn't want to go too far down that rabbit hole either. So
yeah, okay. Yeah, Iggy is the same. Battletech is that he believes is owned by TOPS, and Catalyst licenses it from them. So
that's correct. Yeah. And I think TOPS has a new ownership as well. But so far, they've been pretty much leaving Catalyst to their own devices because I mean, Catalyst have been doing pretty well for themselves, as I say, with the Kickstarters and the general direction of the product. So it doesn't seem to be much in the way of editorial interference. Like, they're pretty much saying, like, listen, as long as you guys continue to make money and keep your customers happy, then we're happy. So,
yeah. Well, I'm sure they don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, you know. So that'd be obvious. Okay, well, I think with that we will wrap it up for this evening before we get on a different topic or drag this one out too long. So,
yeah.
So, Gary, you have a good night.
Have a good night, Paul.
Okay. So, okay. Big surprise. Things didn't go as planned. That's nothing new around here. But obviously, we got to talk a little bit about Starfleet Battle Force and how we feel like the market is when it comes to the different games, you know. And obviously, I probably should look a little more into the tactical board games because obviously Battletech is quite popular, and that's akin basically to Federation Commander when it comes to, in my mind, the level of understanding and complication. I think Federation Commander might be a little more because of. Unless they really change the rules drastically for Battletech, you know, the only thing you have to worry about was heat and ammunition, and that was it. You know, you don't have to worry about in the case of like Federation Commander. You have to worry about, okay, do you have enough drones? You know, is things charged, things like that, which you have to track a little differently. So you know, which makes things a little more complicated. You know. You know, just time bit versus just, you know, you have expendables and you use up the expendables. So I'm not sure if there are other tactical board games that are new tactical board games, not old ones, because Battletech is pretty old. You know, Battletech is just is newer than Starfleet Battles, but it's still very old. It's just a little bit newer than Starfleet Battles, to be honest. Because I remember Battletech back in my college days, back in the 80s. So, at least, it is an old game. And the question is, are there any new games? Now, these are board games, tactical board games, that have been created. You know, I know that tactical games, at least the ones I hear about, are on computers. You know, so. Or, you know, how they abstracted out element of the Euro games. But anyhow, we got to talk about that. We got to talk a little bit about Star Trek, and Lord knows that's always a rabbit hole that easily can go very, very deep. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.